Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
This is Writers on Film, the only podcast dedicated to books on cinema. Okay, everybody, hello and welcome to Writers on Film. My name is John Bleasdale. I am a writer and film critic, and today I am going to be talking to Stephen Lee Nash on the music and sound in the films of Dennis Hopper. And we're going to be talking about Dennis Hopper generally as a filmmaker and specifically as a director. Obviously talk about his presence, his screen presence, and his acting as well. Before I go on with today's episode, I'd like to just spend a moment to note the passing of David Bordwell. He is an influential film writer. Well, to say he's an influential film writer, I think, would understate the case. Many people have studied film using his textbooks, which never read like textbooks, and also subscribing to his principles, which had a breadth and depth of film knowledge, which took in genre cinema as much as art house and took everything seriously, and was full of articulate analysis and enthusiasm, sharp observations, and a wonderful, coherent way of communicating his thoughts about film. He was going to be a guest on Writers on Film. He was one of the people who I wanted to have on my wish list, and we were going to do it. Perplexing Plots, his new book, was what we were going to talk about, but unfortunately, his state of health at that point made it impossible for us to record the episode, and it's a small loss compared to the huge loss of his passing. So I just wanted to take a moment to talk about that at the top of the episode today. If you enjoy the conversation that I have with Stephen, please remember to like, you can subscribe to the podcast, and if you wish, you can also leave a review, which does an enormous amount of good. And before you do any of that, please enjoy the conversation.
You know, I grew up on a council estate in middle of England, and you know, the lives of Hollywood actors really probably didn't have much impact on my life at all, but for some reason, Dennis Hopper has always kind of appealed to me. And obviously, I'm a child of the 90s. You know, I grew up, I started that decade as a 9-year-old and ended it as a 19, 20-year-old. So I was aware of Dennis Hopper just as a sort of figure of that decade, as someone who was in films like Speed and Waterworld and Super Mario Brothers, you know, these kind of like mainstream films. He had a cool name, so it obviously kind of jumped out at you a little bit. But as I got older and became, reading film material, or just kind of like lifestyle, male lifestyle magazines and things like that, you realize he would crop up in these magazine and newspaper articles as someone who kind of like survived the 1960s, and at that point as well, there was kind of a revisionist kind of thing in the UK media anyway, about sort of the 1960s, because we had bands like Oasis and who were referencing things from like the Beatles and 60s movies and things like that. So there was this kind of revisionist thing going on anyway. So yeah, he was just kind of like a name that I would recognize, alongside lots of other names like Jack Nicholson, Marlon Brando, these kind of decadent figures from that era. But yeah, and then in the late 90s, I went to film school, and I was studying, and this is back in Leicester, studying film and media. Just talking with my fellow students on the course, we would recommend lots of films to each other. One week I would watch like a film like The Deer Hunter or something like that, and one of my friends would say, "Oh, hey, if you liked that movie, why don't you check out Apocalypse Now? Because that's also a great Vietnam War film." So I would, go check out that. And then 3/4 of the way through that film, Dennis Hopper shows up as this kind of madcap war photographer or photojournalist, and kind of like hijacks the film for about 20 to 30 minutes. So I was like, okay, that's kind of blown me away. And then, another thing would be like, how do I get into the work of David Lynch? Because, back then you kind of felt like David Lynch was this kind of weird avant-garde film director. But, it was oh, so yeah, you should go check out Blue Velvet. That's his most sort of straightforward film. And of course, you'd go watch Blue Velvet, and again, there's Dennis Hopper appearing and hijacking the film for, a good majority of it. And same with, like, I was a big Quentin Tarantino fan in the 90s, and one of my friends would say, "Oh, he wrote this film called True Romance. He didn't direct it, but he wrote it, and it was directed by Tony Scott." And yeah, there's Dennis Hopper appearing in that film too. So he just kind of like kept reappearing in films that kind of interested me. And then yeah, I remember again just like going to the now defunct Virgin Megastores, as they were selling off their VHS collections for relatively very little money. I remember picking up Easy Rider. I picked up Mean Streets by Martin Scorsese, and I picked up, I think, like Clockwork Orange or something like that. But yeah, I just happened to put Easy Rider on to my VHS top loader, and on a Sunday morning or something like that, feeling a little hungover or whatever, and yeah, just really engaged with that film. And Dennis Hopper obviously directed Easy Rider. He also appears in it as well, and it just seemed to make a quite a big impact on me. And yeah, I just became kind of more interested in his work. I would There was several biographies around about him at that time, so I would read those, and I would come across lots of other films. Obviously, there was a huge back catalog, decades of work, that films that he directed or films that he'd appeared in, films that were pretty notorious. I just kept going back and back and rediscovering, well, not rediscovering, but discovering for the first time things like his photography work that he did in the 1960s, kind of documenting the civil rights movement, and also documenting the sort of early Hollywood as well. Well, the sort of, not early Hollywood, but sort of the early new Hollywood of the sort of late 1960s and early 70s. And he was also a visual artist as well, so there's lots of artwork and things like that, lots of exhibitions that he did. And yeah, he's just kind of one of these fascinating guys who has like who contains multitudes of talent. It starts with the acting, but you kind of dig in deeper. It's directing, it's photography, it's visual art. So I was just really taken with that. And just, really the journey's never stopped for me. I've continued to really dig into the work of Dennis Hopper. I write about it quite often. I find films that I've never heard of before, that appear on YouTube and Tubi and places like that, these kind of streaming channels, and just always intrigued to see anything that I've never seen before.
Let's get into Easy Rider, because that's one of those films. Well, that's the film, the key film, I think, his first film as a director, and the film where, as you say, he's sort of bringing together these interests, acting, the alternative lifestyle, the alternative 60s sort of vibe that's going on, but also popular music, rock music, and that's the focus of your book as well, the use of music and in the soundtracks of these movies specifically.
So yeah, Easy Rider, to me, it feels like putting on a record, if you rather than putting on a film. It's kind of, the music is so important and so impactful to that film. I think without it, it would be probably a lesser movie. I think it would probably be remembered as slightly more fondly, a more extravagantly shot kind of biker exploitation film of the 1960s that were pretty popular at that time. But the music kind of sets it alight. Laszlo Kovacs, the cinematographer, plays a big part in how that film looks. I mean, it's a beautifully shot film, these beautiful wide vistas of the American landscape. But alongside the music as well, it really kind of generates a more emotional response to those scenes. And it also, I think, because the movie itself is, obviously it had a screenplay. It was written by Dennis Hopper along with Peter Fonda and a guy called Terry Southern as well, who was a sort of big player in the 1960s counterculture. But really it's an improvised performance in some ways. So there was a screenplay, but a lot of the time it was very loose. There's not a lot of political background in that film, I don't think. They don't really mention things like the civil rights movement or the Vietnam War that was ongoing, the dying like months of the Democratic administration at that time, that it was going to switch to Nixon, you know. And but I think the music actually does the political legwork in that film and sort of attaches it to the times, basically, for good or bad.
There's also a sense that in the 60s, you know, when if anybody gets shot, then, or if there's any violence whatsoever, then it's automatically going to be, that's Vietnam coming out, or that's the Kennedy assassination coming out. You know, Nashville has an assassination scene, and there's a bit of me that thinks, well, they could be references to that, but they also could just be the things themselves. As a Jesuitic axiom of everything is the thing itself, not everything is connected. I thought you were excellent on that contradiction in Hopper, that he dresses like this countercultural sort of guy, but at the same time his own politics in Easy Rider as his character is kind of extremely thin. You know, he's very cynical about the commune that he meets, and you know, he's very the time you see a black person in the film, he's kind of seems to be a moment that could break out into psychotic violence because he's staring him down at the Mardi Gras. I mean, Hopper always has the feeling of somebody who could, he's like a Begsy character from Trainspotting, someone who could glass you at a loving.
His screen presence is often menacing and very uneasy. He has this kind of twitchy, wide-eyed expression which he pulls out quite a lot, and he's like a Rottweiler or even like a bulldog or something like that. You know, because he wasn't big in stature, he was quite a small guy, but he has a real intimidation on screen. But yeah, there's also, yeah, there is this kind of this politics as well that goes on. I mean, you know, this Easy Rider was obviously made for a younger audience for the time, but you know, Hopper was 33 when he directed that film. He was no spring chicken, you know. But you know, I think he was tied in very well with youth culture. He knew how to sort of market his films towards a younger audience, but it was mostly done through music. You see that in Easy Rider, you see it in Out of the Blue, which is a film that comes a little later, and you certainly see it in Colors as well with its hip-hop soundtrack. I mean, Colors was directed in 1988, and Hopper was in his late 40s, early 50s at that point, you know. But yeah, he really knows how to sort of embrace youth culture, but it is mostly done through music.
I mean, it's so funny. It's amazing that point that you make about him being in his 30s and the late 60s, because of course he was a kid, you know, coming up with James Dean. He was in, you know, he turns up in all these films that you think of as totally another generation as the young guy. Cool Hand Luke, I remember he pops up in at one point.
Correct. Yeah.
And he was almost like, there's always a little bit of me that suspects that he had a little bit of a kind of being professionally James Dean's best friend, you know, that there was a little bit of the hanger on to him, that he was riding his coattails a little bit.
I totally agree with that. Yeah, I think obviously, you know, in they were friends on set for sure. I'm not sure how much they hung out together in their sort of personal lives, but they appeared in two movies together, and Hopper's always was always you know, able to say that, you know, James Dean made three movies and he was in two of them, Rebel Without a Cause and Giant. And the other James Dean movie is East of Eden. So he only made three films, and you know, his impact on culture from that point has always been very, very high. But yeah, I do sort of agree with that. I feel like yeah, Hopper kind of rode those coattails, and you know, kind of in effect had the career if James Dean had stayed alive. You know, I think James Dean would have potentially had the same kind of career trajectory that Dennis Hopper kind of had too. So. Yeah.
So him moving into directing, because I mean he burnt bridges. He burnt so many bridges. It's surprising that, you know, he managed to continue a career for as long as he did, because he sort of got kicked out of Hollywood when he was an actor. Then he would, you know, he rode the success of Easy Rider into his next movie, the last movie, which was sort of like, probably unironically titled that, because I can't imagine him thinking this is going to be a huge hit. But that's a film that has been rediscovered, I think. I'm not sure if it's had a Criterion release or I've got a lot more time for it than I did when I first saw it, put it that way.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think it has had, it's had a restoration and a reissue for sure. And it is being, I think, rediscovered as a really interesting avant-garde film that was actually made with studio money as well. And I think it's an incredibly interesting film. And I agree with you when you say, like, I have more time for it now than I did when I first watched it. But I think that sometimes the realization of that is that I watched it in incredibly bad circumstances, you know, like the film transfer that I had someone sent me a DVD that was on a CDR of the film, and it was incredibly bad. And, you know, it was obviously filmed off a projector screen or something like that. Seeing it in better condition in the last few years, you know, having that restoration and having a bit more context as well with the film, a lot more sort of writing about the film has occurred. And I think it's a really great and interesting film. I wouldn't say that it's one of Hopper's best like films that he directed, and certainly not one that he acted in, but I just think that there was an interesting film that was being made there. And I think what happened was that it kind of got lost in the editing process. So this, it goes back a few years, but Stuart Stern, who was a screenwriter in Hollywood, he wrote Rebel Without a Cause. Him and Hopper actually wrote the screenplay for the last movie together. And it, according to him, it was a very straightforward film. And when they went to Peru to make this film it would have been 1970, they were, you know, the drugs and the hedonism kind of interrupted on the actual making of that film. But then also going back into the editing a year later, you know, Hopper was just, you know, wild. He was really strung out, burned out, I think. And yeah, he made a film which I think is trying in some respects to be antagonistic and provocative. And it certainly was at the time. You know, the audiences at that moment were not wanting to watch a film that was non-linear, that was, you know, with very harsh editing cuts, a very overwhelming use of sound. And yeah, I mean, obviously it wasn't really given a chance either. I mean, Universal Studios hated it. They buried it. And, you know, Hopper went through most of his life trying to resurrect this film. You know, he would show it at, you know, college campuses and places like that to try and get some, you know, appreciation for it. And I think it's finally got it. Like, I think that, you know, after his death and with the kind of reassessment of Dennis Hopper in the last couple of well, the last decade, really, after his death as a visual artist and as a photographer, the last movie kind of coattails on that reassessment, I think. So, but I mean, personally, I've watched that movie a bunch of times. I have such a good time watching it. I really do. There's a lot going on there.
It's an incredibly meta movie as well. I mean, you know, meta is a bit one of those words you try to avoid if at all possible. But here it is really justified as a word, because the whole movie, well, it's called The Last Movie. It's about an actor, a stuntman, sort of hanging around in a Peruvian location after the film has finished filming, and sort of eventually the villagers, in a sort of occult magic sort of way, have made sacred the instruments of the means of production of the film, really, and sort of have these rituals, and it has a real power to it. And the idea of making that as a straight movie feels almost like a contradiction. So the fact that it's not straight, it's not straightforward, is to me in keeping with it. And I know what you mean by it being delivered to you. Sometimes films are delivered to you not just in terms of, you know, what quality, you know, crappy VHS or whatever, but also in terms of a critical predisposition. And I remember being shown Last Movie and being told, oh, this is the terrible movie he made after the Easy Rider. Not, you know, this is a really interesting film. Keep your mind open while you watch it, but like watching it as a disaster, which is something, I don't know if you know, Michael Cimino's Heaven's Gate, if you watch it in the 1980s, you might think, oh, it's terrible. And then you watch it in the 2000s, you think it's a misunderstood classic purely because the cultural atmosphere around it has changed.
Absolutely. Yeah, no, that I'm in full agreement there. I remember before I'd even really seen the last movie or was even really invested much in the work of Dennis Hopper, you know, I remember reading those articles, which was like, you know, the 25 or 50 disastrous movies of the last, you know, the 20th century or something like that. And it would be sort of in there in the list of films alongside, you know, Ed Wood and the Heaven's Gate.
Not the
saga,
Tim Burton Ed Wood, but the films of Ed Wood, like Planet Nine.
Planet Nine. Yes, exactly. So it would be mentioned in that breath. Mm. And originally, I guess when I first saw the film in its entirety and in the state that I did, I was kind of disappointed in it. But disappointed to see that it wasn't as I guess I was kind of disappointed in the film, but yeah, as I said, reassessment and education has just kind of opened up that film for me way more, and I think it deserves its praise. It deserves its reassessment.
Yeah, yeah. And with those two films, that was sort of rounding off a period that he was at his height in terms of as a director. Not in terms of talent or accomplishment, but opportunity, perhaps. That with Easy Rider, he opened the doors, and with Last Movie, he closed them as far as Hollywood was concerned, until later on. And you describe how sort of he throws himself into acting throughout the 70s, and he's in this is the thing I can't quite get with Hopper, and perhaps you'll be able to help me out here. He has this reputation for being so crazy and drug-fueled and all the rest of it, none of which I doubt to be true. But then sometimes you'll see a movie like Tracks, and you just wonder, you know, how... he has disciplined performances, you know. He obviously, you know, and even Easy Rider and last movie, for all the excesses and all the rest of it, they're still not created by someone who's totally out of control. There's talent there. There's vision there. There is a mind working here.
Yeah, yeah, completely. And so I think it's really interesting. I actually have a lot of time for that sort of lost period of Dennis Hopper's work, this kind of like the 1970s and the early 1980s, as a period of time where he wasn't working excessively. You know, he'd probably only make one or two movies every couple of years, but they usually were outstanding films. And Tracks is definitely a superb film, and a very understated performance by Dennis Hopper. I mean, he keeps it pretty low key throughout the entire film. There's a few moments in there where he kind of does his, you know, classic sort of Hopperisms, but it's usually a very, very quiet, low key performance. But I think the actually you can really see it as well in Apocalypse Now, in which he plays this very burned out PTSD suffering photojournalist who's embedded with Marlon Brando's Colonel Kurtz in the Cambodian jungle. And, you know, he's all over the place. He's incredibly wild, you know, a million thoughts a minute. He can't get the words out.
Zapping with your sirens, man. Zapping with your sirens.
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's a real jarring performance, because that film has maintained a kind of slow and steady pace with just a few little dots of sort of eccentric performances, Robert Duvall's kind of character showing up and things like that. But that performance is so jarring because it's so out of the it's so unexpected and out of the ordinary for that film. But then, you know, he finishes Apocalypse Now. He's got the long hair. He's kind of straggly and looking really worn out. And then he flies to Hamburg to appear in Wim Wenders' film, The American Friend, in which he plays the character Tom Ripley from the Ripley novels. And he's this suave American, suited, clean shaven, you know, neat haircut. And again, a very restrained performance. And there's like a week in between him appearing in Apocalypse Now and appearing in that film. And it's like there could be years there. He puts in a really subtle, a really good performance in both films, but they're very different, but they're really back to back. But it gets a little bit more wild as kind of like time goes on. You know, when we get into the 1980s, you know, he wasn't working much in American films at all. He was really going to Europe to act. And one of the sort of breaking points is a film called White Star, which was directed by a German director called Roland Glick. And in that, he is off the rails, I would say, and very much the persona of Dennis Hopper that we kind of see in our popular culture as a wild man, and that transfers and bleeds into the film itself. And if you haven't seen that film, I really recommend it as a film that really shows an actor really in free fall at that point, and in a very dangerous place, I would say. And it's good that he managed to, you know, the year after White Star, to get clean from drugs and booze, and you know, come back in the mid to late 1980s with, you know, Blue Velvet, River's Edge, Hoosiers, and become a more respectable actor within Hollywood and independent films as well. So yeah, it's all there for sure. It's all there for the taking.
Also, I mean, in terms of that persona of the you include in the book on the chapter on the last movie, you also talk about the documentary that is made concurrently with that, and which he kind of ends up sort of directing, or certainly the force of his personality to some degree seems to be shaping and pointing that film in a certain direction. That's a really fascinating document as well.
It is, yeah. And it kind of really shows, I guess, where the last movie went wrong as well. Because, you know, it takes place, it's called The American Dreamer. And it's, you know, just a documentary crew following him around during the post-production process of the last movie. It's he's held up in Taos, New Mexico, which is where he was living at the time, in this kind of compound. You know, this compound had its own little cinema. It had its own cutting room and everything like that. So he was just there for you know, a good period, maybe a year to, you know, year to 18 months editing the last movie. But yeah, it really shows where the distractions were happening. You know, at one point, a bus of Playboy bunnies show up to appear, you know, to kind of take part in this, you know, group sex. They call it something else. I forget what it is. Some sort of they don't call it that, but that's what basically happens. So Hopper's just surrounded by Playboy bunnies at the time. You can tell there's lots of drugs, there's lots of booze, there's lots of hangers-on in these in his compound, and it really is distracting, I think, from the direction that the last movie potentially could have gone in. You know, there's a scene where he's watching rough edits of the film, and it's really not coming together at all. And, you know, you can tell he's just bored by the whole process. And then a little bit later on, you start seeing images from the last movie, and you can sort of see the gears in his head kind of working, and he becomes much more interested in making a film, in finishing the film. But you can also tell that there's definitely an antagonism that he has with the studio and his, you know, and his place within popular culture, I guess, as well. I kind of feel like he's already feeling like he's being left behind. And this process is taking far too long. And, you know, he has this definite vision that he wants to put out there. And he had final cut on the last movie, so they couldn't really do anything about that. But there's really, the sort of film is just not materializing until it does, I suppose. And it materializes in the way that we see it today. And it's a very nonlinear kind of avant-garde neo-realism kind of film, you know. So it's very interesting. But the documentary, yeah, The American Friend, really does show that there was a lot of distraction happening at that point. And yes, you're right. He does end up being the kind of directing force of it. He doesn't have the directing credit or anything like that. But, you know, there's scenes within that movie where he sort of says, you guys should go here, film me here, film me walking across this bit. Hey, let's go down to the suburbs. Let's go to where the squares are, you know, and I'll take off all my clothes and I'll walk down the street naked and things like that. You know, these things that he wanted in the film. He wanted to show the sort of shocking nature of his persona, I guess. So, yeah, he takes over that film for sure.
I mean, it's that, I don't know, there's also that, I mean, this is one question that I always struggle with a little bit with Dennis Hopper, or more than a little, I should say. And that is that element of misogyny in his character, the way he treats women, the way he's treated women in his private life, the way that actually bleeds into the movies as well, where you see women being, you know, maltreated, Easy Rider, you know, they go to a brothel and pick up two prostitutes, and they're not, being, you know, I mean, there's just no women in that movie who are being related to as particularly fully rounded human beings. And similarly, in the last movie, is it Karen Black who gets a real, he's really maltreating in that film? There's one of the female characters, anyway, does get a right. I'm not sure if he's hitting.
I think the only prominent female character in that is actually, I can't remember her name, which is awful, but she is also a sex worker.
Right. Exactly.
Karen,
yeah.
Black, I don't believe, is in there, but I think she is also a sex worker who he develops a relationship with, and yes, he treats her horribly in that film as well. Yeah.
Yeah, and I mean, if it wasn't, it's. Is it Stella Garcia? Is it plays Maria?
Correct. Yep. That's the.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
That's the female actress, yes.
I don't know, it's just, I mean, this is a common thing with the 60s where you go, oh, liberation and free love and free ideas and all this thing. And it seems to almost be a doubling down on now we can really treat women badly. And even with the new Hollywood, there's this sense of we can, you know, we're no longer restricted by censorship. We can film things. And so how many rape scenes can we do in, you know, per movie? So I don't know. It's just that I guess you're, these days we're always talking about separating the art from the artist, and he is someone who is not always crossing that line, but frequently confusing blurring the line in between those two things.
Yeah, I have no argument at all for that. He treated women in his movies potentially the way that he treated them in real life, you know. He had five wives. None of those marriages ended particularly well, including his last one, and on his deathbed. And you know, when you look at his directorial films, for sure, like, women are pretty much absent. And I talk about this in from the soundtrack perspective as well, and certainly in Easy Rider, there's a few female voices that you can kind of hear drifting in and out of some of the songs. They're backing vocalists there. They have writing credits on one or two tracks, but mostly it's an all male soundtrack. You continue on into any of his soundtracks, Out of the Blue, it's Neil Young. It's predominantly a Neil Young soundtrack. There's a punk band called The Pointed Sticks. They're all men. And, predominantly in the film Colors as well, the hip hop artists are male MCs, but there is Salt-N-Pepa and Roxanne Shanté do appear on those soundtracks, so I will give him credit there. But then, you know, the last film that I talk about in the book is a film called The Hotspot, which actually does have two female leads, but the soundtrack is all male. It's Miles Davis and John Lee Hooker, plus a male session musicians that create that soundtrack. And the only real film that where a female protagonist is present is Out of the Blue. And I will give him some credit. You know, he creates in that film a pretty solid feminist icon in the role of CB, who's played by Linda Manns. She's tough as nails. She takes the situation that's thrown at her into her own hands and fires it all back at them. And, you know, for one thing, she is a very strong female character. But again, you know, soundtracked by males, all the circumstances that lead to her demise is by male abuse. Yeah, so it's a shocking sort of state of affairs. But it is very, very reminiscent of the times that he came up in, you know, just a very, very male-dominated culture.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's not, I'm not suggesting in any way, I mean, I think there is something to be said for his revealing of that. He's not, there's no hypocrisy, or there's no, you know what I mean? He's especially in Out of the Blue, where he plays the abusive father who is horrific. I mean, absolutely horrific character, and starts off as kind of CB's hero, and then, you know, you gradually understand that this guy's a complete loser and doesn't have her best interests at heart. In fact, far the opposite. That's a wonderful, stirring performance by Linda Manns as well. Obviously, she came to fame, one of my favorite films ever, Days of Heaven. And this comes, so Days of Heaven is 78, so this is only a couple of years after that, right?
It is, yeah. It's actually very surprising, because, you know, Out of the Blue was meant to be just this small Canadian TV movie that was being made in the late 1970s, and it's very interesting that it attracted Linda Manns and Dennis Hopper. You know, he was only cast initially as the dad in a film, and the film was not in this kind of nihilistic tone that it is now. You know, it was just meant to be like a family TV movie about a girl who kind of gets out of her bad family situation and is kind of redeemed and rescued by the the social security system,
so TV movie of the week sort of
exactly
situation.
yeah but you know, the director who was on there, he walked after a couple of weeks because there was just no usable footage. You know, they hadn't really shot anything that was usable. The financial backers were just ready to throw in the towel, but you know, Hopper took over and he said, I can do this film, I can make it, just give me a weekend to rewrite the script, give me creative control, let me recast a few roles, and then yeah, like, you know, they were ready to go and they shot it in a matter of weeks, edited it in a matter of weeks, and the film was ready to go. But it was completely disowned by the the Canadian Arts Commission or establishment or whatever, and you know, it went to Cannes Film Festival as just a Dennis Hopper movie and not as an official Canadian entry, because they didn't like the tone that the film took, and a lot of people didn't really, and that film was buried for a few decades as well, just because of its shocking kind of subject matter. I read that it was banned in the UK until 1986, I think. So 6 years after it was made, it wasn't even shown in the UK. But, you know, it's not like you could get hold of it anyway. I mean, I don't think it was widely released. I think, you know, the only chance of watching it in the 1980s or 1990s was maybe at a midnight screening or something like that. The first version of that film that I ever watched was actually very similar to the way that I watched the last movie, which was a DVD that I got from a European seller on eBay or something like that. And it was basically just the projection screen and the video camera filming it. And it was a very grimy, you know, film that, at least a very sort of gritty, grimy, really bad sound version of the film. And I was very disappointed again. But then again, this film has faced a kind of restoration and reassessment within popular culture in the last sort of 10 years. And again, it's become a very important film, actually. And, you know, it's shown in festivals around the world. And the DVD and Blu-ray restoration is very beautiful, with lots of really great extras that go dive into the context of the film. And yeah, so it's certainly had a reassessment, that movie.
Yeah, I think if anybody's listening to this hasn't had an opportunity to see it, it comes highly recommended. I think it's much more accessible in terms of watchable than the last movie, although I would also, you know, I'd recommend you see all of these films. But Out of the Blue really is a stunning performance. Performances, actually, because the mother, his best friend, who I think is the screenwriter of Cool Hand Luke, isn't he?
It's Don Gordon.
Yeah. Didn't he write the novel that's Cool Hand Luke was based on, Don Gordon?
That would be so cool if he did. Wait, honestly, I really like Don Gordon as an actor, so it would be really impressive if he did do that.
I might Amazing. Be totally wrong.
Yeah, and Don Gordon also appears.
No,
as
it was Don Pierce. Sorry, it's me.
That's a shame. That's a shame. That would have been very cool. But yeah, Don Gordon appeared with Dennis Hopper also in Out of the Blue. In Out of the Blue, but also in the last movie as one of his deadbeat friends as well. So it's quite interesting. There's these cool little partnerships that Dennis Hopper had throughout his career. Don Gordon being one of them. And Dean Stockwell, Peter Fonda, obviously, as well. He had these little cool little, companionships across his film career. It's quite nice.
Dean Stockwell was in Tracks as well as Blue Velvet with
Tracks
him.
Tracks and Blue Velvet. They were also in Human Highway together as well, which is Neil Young's directorial film, which is bizarre movie. But they're in that together as well. So, yeah.
These connections are wonderful. I love that. And mm-hmm. Don Gordon was also in Bullet as
yes, that's right. I think him and Steve McQueen were actually very good friends. Yeah,
right.
Yeah, very interesting.
What a web we weave.
This is the great thing about Dennis Hopper. You know, that you talk about this whole thing about the Kevin Bacon connections. You know, Kevin Bacon, the actor, having almost just one person away from you know, from in some sort of relationship there. It's the same with Dennis Hopper as well. You know, I mean, he was just around for long enough, I suppose, that you almost you can't sort of not have that. But yeah, like any figure in popular culture, especially in American popular culture of the late 20th century, and somewhere along the line, they've been, you know, they've come across Dennis Hopper somewhere down the line.
Yeah, and it's funny because, as you say, there are sort of moments in his career where he's not necessarily making two or three films a year. He's making one or two films every 2 or 3 years, you know. So moving on to Colors, you're concentrating on soundtracks, and so Colors is, Out of the Blue is very distinct because you've got Neil Young, you've got punk, you've also got that feeling that he's going away from Easy Rider and all the music that's on the soundtrack there to, you know, something which is almost antithetical. And then you've still got Neil Young on top of it. So there's a remnant of the 60s there. Then you come on to Colors and you've got something else which is sort of antithetical, which is sort of saying, look, what about black music, guys? What about this music that isn't, which you haven't really paid any attention to?
Yes, the soundtrack to Colors is a really exceptional snapshot of hip hop and rap music of that time, of the sort of mid-1980s, which was certainly at that point really wasn't mainstream at all. There were obviously remnants of it kind of in, you know, popular music, but as a form itself, you know, there was no huge artist at that moment. So to have a collection, a compilation soundtrack of rap and hip hop was a pretty big deal. And you know, the record that was released that was released by Warner Brothers, you know, became one of like a really great best-selling compilation and really introduced a lot of people to hip hop music. And but what's really interesting, I think, is that firstly, you know, Dennis Hopper was, you know, in his late 40s, early 50s when he made this film, and really in no way connected to hip hop or rap culture or black culture in any sense. But when he made Colors, you know, the film is from the perspective of two white cops played by Sean Penn and Robert Duvall. And during his sort of research, and also during his research for that film, but also just being where he lived at the time, you know, at this point he was living in Venice, in Los Angeles, and you know, he would be at his residence and he would hear the sounds of hip hop music being played kind of by passing cars, or, you know, kids on the street walking past with boomboxes. And like, this stuff was not represented in the popular culture at all, of the mainstream popular culture. This was just stuff that was happening on the streets at this point. So, you know, during his kind of research time and the time that he was, you know, driving around places like Watts and, you know, in Los Angeles and scouting for locations, he would see these groups of kids. They were like tagging walls with graffiti. They were listening to these records on their boomboxes or on their, you know, car stereos or whatever, and or from coming out of their houses. And he just came to this, I guess he just came to this realization that this music really meant something to these kids. And that needed to be incorporated into the film because, you know, we would do this, the film deals with gang culture and the way that it's policed, really. And so the way that you hear the music in the film isn't loud on the soundtrack. It's in any sense, there's one song which you kind of hear by the rapper Ice-T. It's the theme song. It's called Colors, and it's the one song that you kind of just hear on top of the film. It's very loud. It's very abrupt. But the rest of the music that you hear, so all of these different hip hop and rap artists, are basically it's the soundscape of the urban environment. It's coming from kids' boomboxes. It's coming from their cars, and it's coming while these guys are interacting with each other. It's in the background, and I just think that that's actually a really impressive way to do it. It shows the viewer of that movie that this music is embedded within their culture, within this gang culture. I think it's a very neat way of doing it. I mean, it was probably maybe I don't know if it was intentional, but I actually think that it works better that way than having those tracks like Easy Rider just placed over the top while you're watching stuff. You're actually more immersed into it. And I think it works way better.
It's so interesting that this film came out in 1988, and you think of the big sort of hip hop movies or the big movies that come out, like Menace to Society and New Jack City, and they're all coming out like 5 years later, you know, 92, 93. It's really ahead of its time for that use of music and that sort of putting this culture out there in the foreground rather than just as an afterthought.
You know, the dominance of hip hop and rap that kind of came after that film is actually really interesting, and it's actually, you can use Dennis Hopper almost as a signifier for that. You know, back in 88, he directed a film called Colors, which had this hip hop soundtrack, which nobody at the time was at least in like mainstream Hollywood, mainstream music wasn't really represented much. And then 10 years later in 1998, he appears in one of Puff Daddy's music videos, which was like one of the most expensive music videos ever made at that point. I think it's still like 13 on the list or something like that of the most expensive music videos ever made. But back then it was the most expensive. I think the song's called Victory, and it has this whole narrative arc throughout the whole film, throughout the whole music video. You know, the song's about 4 minutes long, but actually the music video is like 8 to 10 minutes long or something like that, because they put these prologues and things like that all on it. So yeah, like Dennis Hopper himself is that representation of how hip hop became so dominant in the 1990s.
It reminds me of like Thriller and that sort of Michael Jackson, yeah, where you get a mini movie rather than a video as such.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. The video to Puff Daddy's Victory is kind of like a take on, The Running Man or something like that. It's kind of set in this dystopian future where, you know, and Dennis Hopper plays this character who kind of oversees this kind of brutal game where people have to survive by on the streets and are chased down. And it's very, very kind of weird and dystopian. It could have made a pretty good movie actually for one of Dennis Hopper's later roles, actually, to be fair. I mean, he kind of took on that role a little bit. A film called Land of the Dead, which was from 2005, which was a zombie movie.
George Romero. Yeah.
So, yeah.
I think that the other sort of like non-movie role that he did, which you mentioned in the book and I think was really interesting, was, and I'd forgotten about, but I remember seeing this and being, you know, provoked, nauseated and disgusted, was that car advert he does where he sort of challenges his former sort of Easy Rider persona digitally inserted and leaves him in the dust literally because he's got a new car. And it's just like, I mean, Jesus Christ, guy. But you can tell he's doing it as a, like, you know, that's my past. I'm not going to live on past glories.
Sure, yeah. And I'm sure the paycheck helped as well for that particular thing. But I think there's a documentary somewhere on YouTube which is like just a little making of documentary for that advert by the sort of production company that made it. And you know, it was the use of green screen, which was not something that was widely used back then when that advert came out, which was like the early 1990s. So I think, you know, Hopper's there and just saying, you know, this is really interesting. They're using, you know, what they're doing. I think he was kind of intrigued about what this new technology was going to do basically to film. So it's kind of interesting that he was there, you know, as one of the first people to kind of sit down and use it. It's a very strange moment for sure.
Yeah. I mean, but it also goes back to like what our earlier part of the discussion when we were talking about Easy Rider, that he's always an uncomfortable presence there anyway. There's no real evidence in Easy Rider that he is somehow typifying the 60s or somehow, you know, his character is just a guy who doesn't mind not cutting his hair. It's not the depth of his political your involvement is, you know, is there's no evidence of it.
Absolutely. No, there isn't. There isn't at all. And, you know, when you sort of look back at Easy Rider in a sort of, you know, from our cultural distance, you kind of know that maybe it's not as radical as it first appeared. You know, it's very much a movie about two people dropping out of society and doing something for themselves and not the collective good of that era that was, you know, promoted during that time, and the rejection as well of things like the hippie commune that they travel through and visit for a while. You know, they reject that collectivism, and yeah, basically it does point towards the 1970s and the 1980s of, you know, we're going to get rich, we're going to focus on the individual, and we're going to reject society, no such thing as, and be for ourselves and look after ourselves. And that could just be a reaction to the sort of 1960s, the radical progressive elements that didn't quite cut through enough in civil rights movements and the women's rights as well, and LGBT. So yeah, it's an interesting perspective, I think, to take. Yeah.
Am I correct in, I always had the feeling with Colors and with The Hot Spot that with these two later films, he was making films which were to some degree more conventional. And I don't know anything about the making of these films, which to some degree makes me wonder if they were much easier productions, much more, you know, painting within the lines. That's the question, really. What was it like? Did he sort of behave on this in this way?
But by this point, he was very professional. Right. We were in the period of time when Hopper had ditched the drugs and the booze. He was very clean. He was also very, very happy and humble to be back working in Hollywood again. Mm-hmm. So he was incredibly professional, like on set. And obviously there was still egotism and dramas for sure. I don't think he got on too well with his some of his actors. I know him and Sean Penn had a very good friendship, but I think him and Robert Duvall on Colors butted heads a few times. The Hot Spot as well. I mean, the actors on that film, you know, failed to show up for the promotional campaign that happened after the film, when the film was released. So we had people like Don Johnson just not even showing up for the promotional. And he was the star of that movie, but at the time he was more interested in a film that might make him, I suppose, a bit more famous or something like that. And I know Virginia Madsen as well, who is in The Hot Spot.
She was in Sideways as well, I think, and Candyman.
Correct. Yeah. And I think that at the time she wasn't too impressed with that film or how that film turned out. But I think she carries, you know, she has to carry quite a load in that movie because there's obviously nudity in her, some of her scenes. She's not a particularly nice character either. So I can sort of imagine that the rejection of that. But I think in retrospect, I read an interview, I'm sure recently, in which she did actually appreciate that film a little bit more as well. And
it kind of came out at the time of the neo-noirs, wasn't it? It was sort of always, there was the John Dahl made two or three films around about that time. And there was this interest in crime cinema, which is sort of which has gone away again, unfortunately, because it's one of my I like a good crime movie.
I kind of feel like it feels sort of very similar to films like Red Rock West,
exactly,
and even David Lynch's Wild at Heart. You know, it has that kind of bright, sunny aesthetic, which I think it was just appealing at that time, and also like Natural Born Killers as well. California, you know, it kind of comes at that time, but it's unfortunately it doesn't move as quickly as those films, and it's a very I don't know. It's a very extravagant film for Dennis Hopper, but it moves at a very leisurely pace. And actually, you know, it's jazz score. It's jazz blues hybrid score that was done by Miles Davis, John Lee Hooker, and a few other prominent session musicians of that time. You know, kind of matches its very kind of hazy disposition, I guess. So it kind of, the soundtrack to that movie actually works pretty well. And I, again, I like it. It's a very understated film, I think. And but just not a lot of eccentricity in that film. It is a very straightforward production. And, you know, Hopper was basically at this point, you know, the hired hand for for the studios. Although, you know, he did you know, have some say in how the film's developed. They were still studio pictures, really. So he couldn't, the antagonisms of his, and, you know, the fire of his previous works, which I think kind of ends with Colors. I think Colors is kind of his last movie that you could sort of say had a political bent. It gets replaced with, rather than a generational wars that kind of exist within his first four films, kind of gets, it's, it gets replaced with a war of the sexes. It becomes much more about, you know, men and women's relationships as opposed to generational relationships that kind of were at the heart of the antagonisms of his films.
Yeah, and you just reminded me, mentioning The Hired Hand, which of course was Pete Fonda's follow-up to Easy Rider. And if anybody wants to see that, that's a really interesting. It's kind of like a superior Monty Hellman Western, I think. It's got that sort of...
Yeah, I watched that recently, and yeah, I really enjoyed that. Again, that was a film that seemed to disappear for a long time as well, and has only had recently had a kind of reassessment. What I find really interesting is that, you know, Hopper and Fonda were given carte blanche after Easy Rider to make whatever they wanted, really. And they both went and made Westerns. So, you know, within this new Hollywood, they had this opportunity to go and make some contemporary. Well, actually, that's not fair, because the last movie is a contemporary film in some respects, but it harks back to the past. You know, it harks back to the Westerns of the 1930s and 40s. But yeah, so that, you know, they could have made these very contemporary stories set in a very sort of contemporary urban America of the 1970s. But they didn't. They made Westerns, which is very interesting, I think. Yeah, they were basically children of the studio system.
I was exactly what I was going to say. Yeah, that's they knew nothing of the streets. They only knew, I mean, you know, Hopper knew more about the streets later on because he kind of had his studio there. He had his you know, when he's making Colors, because he's been living in a neighborhood in Los Angeles with you know, he had a huge art collection and something which was like a bunker that
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, they were both of the bourgeoisie for sure. So yeah, pretty funny. Yeah,
brilliant. Listen, I have one last question, Stephen, which I ask all my guests, which is for a film book recommendation. So you can choose any book you like.
Wow.
Yeah, I'm hitting you with it.
Yeah, no, good one. Let me see. Oh gosh. You know, I'm just reading this book called Road to Nowhere, and I'm just going to look up the author really quickly because it's published by an academic press. And yeah, it's actually, I haven't even finished this book. I'm just reading it right now, and it is so intriguing. It's called The Road Trip to Nowhere, Hollywood Encounters the Counterculture. It's by an academic called John Lewis. It's published by the University of California Press. I think it came out in July 2022. And so, you know, I'm not even finished this book, but I'm really enjoying it. It's, you know, it's right up my alley, basically, in terms of what I like to read about a film. It's, you know, it takes in films like Easy Rider, Zabriskie Point, well, so far anyway. And yeah, just it, so far I'm just really, really enjoying it, and I really recommend it. It's so far, it's a great read.
The Zabriskie Point reminds me that there's an Orson Welles when he was making The Other Side of the Wind, Hopper turned up, and they were inviting loads of people over to Welles's house, which was very close to where Antonioni filmed Zabriskie Point, and that was part of the other side of the wind's idea, was to mimic, you know, he didn't like the what Antonioni was doing, so it was to mimic this European art perspective of America. And there's actually a documentary, and I think it's called something like Hopper / Wells or Wells / Hopper.
That's right. Yes. It's it came out or discovered really a few years ago, and it's just a camera pointed at these two, and they're just drinking and talking and eating, and really fascinating. But as a film itself, it's kind of it's more like a DVD extra,
yes,
than sort of this, you know. I think that it's just an intriguing little moment between the two of them, I guess. Yeah, they were quite good friends, and quite similar in retrospect too. You know, Orson Welles kind of lost his career after a few initially, you know, brilliant films, and never really recovered.
Yeah, they both liked the smell of burning bridges, I think.
They really did. Yeah, they really did. Fascinating. Yeah, really cool.
Brilliant, Stephen. Thanks so much for the book, and thanks so much for joining me for a conversation.
I appreciate your time. Thank you so much, John.
Deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.